long after our puppy, Sunny, had joined the family, he went missing. In his short time with us, he had become a beloved member of the family. My kids, who had met the puppy at Grandma's house when he was newly born and fallen in love, had undertaken a concerted campaign to get Christopher and I to agree to adopt him. They went all out. The usual promises, I'll walk him. Reasoned arguments, here's why it's important to add a puppy to the house. My daughter even agreed to get a job in order to help with the costs. And of course, they both use their own puppy dog eyes to beg mom and dad. Over a short break from school, Christopher and the kids drove over to meet Grandma halfway between her house and ours. When Sunny came to Kalispell and I picked him up for the first time, I completely melted. He was surely the softest, snuggliest puppy ever to exist. And although he grew into a fair amount of mischief making as he got bigger, he remained a good-natured, cuddly little guy who was finding a bigger and bigger place in our hearts. And now this very important member of the family was missing. We checked everywhere, not under the bed, not shut away behind a door, not in a bedroom, not locked in the garage, just not anywhere. Fear began to rise. What if he was gone forever? Finally, someone thought to open the front door. There was Sunny, perched on the front step, patiently waiting for us to discover him. If he could have talked, he might have said, "What? Didn't you know to look for me at my family's house? That's where I belong." Our gospel reading today tells the story of another beloved family member going missing. Jesus was 12 years old at the time of our story. He and his family had taken a 3-day journey to Jerusalem for the big Passover celebration and were now returning home. They were traveling in a caravan for safety, and it would have been normal for parents and neighbors and friends to be watching over one another's children. So when Mary and Joseph didn't see Jesus for a little while, they thought nothing of it. But as time went on, he still didn't show up. That sick feeling in the pit of their stomach began to grow and grow. When they couldn't find Jesus anywhere and nobody knew where he was, their fear grew to the point that they decided they had better retrace their steps to Jerusalem. The story skips a lot and cuts right to the scene in Jerusalem, but imagine what these 3 days were like for Jesus' parents while they were looking for him. Were they blaming themselves? That's probably what I would have been doing. Were they picturing all manner of horrible things that had happened to him? Maybe he was kidnapped or he was robbed on the road to Jerusalem. Maybe he'd gotten lost, injured. Maybe he'd been attacked by a wild animal. At any rate, when they finally arrived back in Jerusalem, they ended up at the temple. And there they found Jesus, sitting patiently, talking theology, and calmly asking, "Why didn't you check here first? Didn't you know I had to be in my father's house?" We can certainly, we certainly can't blame Mary for being a bit upset in that moment. She had suffered for days, thinking she might have lost her precious son forever. And now he had the audacity to be calm, to be safe. All the parents could understand this. You could picture her saying something like, "Jesus, thank goodness you're alive. Now I'm going to kill you. You scared the heck out of me." Mary and Joseph's reaction also shows us something else, though. More than 12 years had passed since they had each received angelic visitations announcing the coming birth of God with us, Jesus, the long-awaited Messiah. The shock of the angels, the unconventional way of the baby being conceived, the rumors floating around the neighborhood, and the angel choir sending a group of shepherds to the manger to worship Jesus, in the drudgery of daily life, 12 years of it, Mary and Joseph might have let those miraculous occurrences fade into the background. After all, there were more children to raise, there were mouths to feed, work to be done, learning of the Torah, cleaning, sleeping, rising, doing it all over again the next day. Maybe they started to tell themselves that they'd imagined all that angel stuff, that they had let themselves get caught up in the moment, exaggerated maybe even what they saw and heard. After all, Didn't Jesus act much like any other child? They were comfortable with him, comfortable with the family, plenty busy without a lot of time for miraculous revelations. They may have barely noticed how quickly Jesus was growing into a man. But then the crisis happened. The crisis jarred them to attention, to focus. Suddenly, there was nothing more important than finding Jesus, talking to him, being with him. They searched frantically, their hearts in their throats. Jesus had their full attention. The crisis provoked an adjustment. It forced them to change how they saw the world and Jesus themselves. When they did finally find him, they were confronted head on with who he is. The roles adjust, yes, they do still raise him, and he's their child, and he's obedient to them, but the otherworldliness about him, the call on his life, his identity as Son of God, come into bold focus. You might call the crisis a revelation with implications for the rest of your life. Referring to this story and another story that Luke told, that of the walk to Emmaus, where, as you remember, after Jesus' resurrection, he was revealed to two of his disciples on the road to Emmaus. N.T. Wright says, "You may call the pair of stories something like, on finding the Jesus you thought you'd lost. And if that is the message of these two passages, maybe Luke is wanting to tell us something about his gospel as a whole. Maybe he is writing, at one level at least, for people who may have some idea of Jesus, but find he is more elusive than they had imagined. Finding him, of course, will normally involve a surprise. Jesus didn't do or say what Mary and Joseph, or the two of them on the road, were expecting. It will be like that with us, too. Every time we relax and think that we really understand him, he will be up ahead, or perhaps staying behind, while we go on without thinking. Discipleship always involves the unexpected." We go through times of being overly comfortable in our faith, comfortable with our church friends and our family heritage, and the fact that, of course, we believe in God. We're a little distracted, though, sometimes, if we're honest. There are rides to school, doctor's visits, births, deaths, holidays, dishes to wash, and carpets to clean, and homework to finish, and deadlines for the boss. And that can be okay for a while. God is, after all, present in the ordinariness of everyday life. That's the point of the incarnation. Philippians 2 tells us that he emptied himself of his divine privileges in order to come and walk among us. But as human beings, we also need times of startling focus to call our attention again to what is most important, and to galvanize us in living out what we say we believe. And in many cases, the way that startling focus comes along is through a crisis. So I'm going to tell you a few short stories of Christians who have experienced a crisis, a revelation that changes how they view Jesus and the world going forward. A Christian couple, Greg and Lynn McDonald, were startled awake when they discovered their son was gay. Having lived in the conservative Christian world for a long time, they at first had no idea what to do or how they should respond as Christians. They admit they did the wrong thing a lot at first. But along the way, their heart became more tender. They began to viscerally understand conservative parents who were confused and disoriented when their child came out. Parents who very much wanted to hold on to their faith and remain faithful to whatever God wanted of them, but had no idea what that was and no one to talk to about it. Over time, Greg and Lynn began to realize that the church was doing a terrible job of loving queer kids and their parents. They would say, too often when a child comes out of the closet, the parent goes back in. Greg and Lynn decided to devote their lives to helping parents have community as they processed a new way of understanding faith, and to helping parents all around the world as they work to better reflect the heart of God. Without the crisis, it's unlikely they would have ever seen the harm that was being done to queer kids and their families and the need for a better way. Maybe a little more dramatic example is the Ten Boom family of Holland. They were devout Christians. They became part of the resistance movement, even finally hiding and sheltering Jewish people in danger amid the Nazi occupation. They could have quietly ignored what was happening in their country, like so many other nice, comfortable people did, but their core values were unshakable. The crisis came when they saw the threats happening to their Jewish neighbors that they knew. And then after those small acts of courage and humanity on behalf of people they knew, it stretched out to courageous acts for neighbors that they didn't know, but neighbors who were in danger. Dora Rodriguez, some of you may have come to hear her speak earlier this year at Northridge Lutheran Church. It was at an event for a nonprofit I helped to lead, Valley Neighbors. And Dora is a remarkable woman with a quiet and beautiful strength within her. She's a woman of deep faith in God and a deep belief in the dignity of every human being. In the early 1980s, Dora escaped persecution and a civil war in her home country of El Salvador to come to the United States. But a terrible tragedy happened along the way. Of the 26 people she was traveling with in the desert, 13 died of heat exposure and thirst. Sounds like an absolutely horrific way to die. The picture of her nearly lifeless body being rescued by border officials helped to launch the modern sanctuary movement. Much of this movement was led by Christians and other people of faith who insisted on protecting people in danger, even when the U.S. government was discarding them. In all the years since Dora survived and was nurtured back to health by the community around her, she has continued to take that time of shocking realization in the desert and put it into working for dignity and safety for immigrants at the southern border of the United States. Through sharing her story, she often becomes that moment of awakening to many other people, too. In his autobiography, Russian dissident Alexei Navalny, who died through likely assassination by Russia's leaders earlier this year, writes of how he managed to maintain his courage amid the drudgery and difficulty of poisoning, prison, separation from loved ones, opposition, and constant threats. This is what he writes. I found this surprising. I have always thought and said openly that being a believer makes it easier to live your life, and to an even greater extent, engage in opposition politics. Faith makes life simpler. He then suggests a way to exercise this. You lie in your bunk bed, looking up at the one above, and ask yourself whether you are a Christian in your heart of hearts. It is not essential for you to believe some old guys in the desert once lived to be 800 years old, or the sea was literally parted in front of someone. But are you a disciple of the religion whose founder sacrificed himself for others, paying the price for their sins? Do you believe in the immortality of the soul and the rest of that cool stuff? If you can honestly answer yes, what is there left for you to worry about? Don't worry about the morrow, because the morrow is perfectly capable of taking care of itself. It is a mercy of God that things happen in our lives that shock us out of the status quo and comfort. God shocks us awake in those times, forces us to see him as he truly is, Lord and Savior, and forces us to see our world and the people in it as he does, as ones whom he loves and calls us to serve. Mary and Joseph got a little comfortable in our story today. Then Jesus got lost, or they thought he did. But when they found where they found him, shocked them awake again as to his identity and redirected their life. We may find those times too, the surprise of Jesus' sudden revelation and the way it redirects us to what's important. May God open our eyes and help us to see. Amen. Turn now to the first Noel, number 300.